Welcome to the Air Force Doctrine Podcast. My name is Nicholas Underwood. On this episode, my co-host Keith Conway and I had the opportunity to sit down with retired Chief of Staff of the Air Force, General David Goldfein. Our conversation with General Goldfein centers around lessons learned in leadership from his combat recovery in Serbia on 2 May 1999, the strategic importance of the combat search and rescue mission, and the future of personnel recovery. Please join us for this incredible interview with Just Dave.
So, sir, thank you so much for being here today. You've given so much to us as a service, as a country, and to continue to give your time. We're incredibly thankful, so thank you so much for being here.
No, thank you. It's an honor to be here.
Yes, sir. So this podcast coincides with the continued development of our personal recovery doctrine. Here in LeMay, we're also developing a leadership doctrine. So we thought that you'd be an ideal individual to kind of provide us some background, some thoughts to help us in our guide. So before we get into PR specifically, as we were researching PR, researching your story, looking at the PJ specifically, what we noticed was a lot of similarities between some of the things you say in your book. And I'll quote one of them is, are you willing to devote yourself 24 hours a day, 7 days a week if necessary? And as we're reading that, and we're also looking at the PR doctrine and some of the PJ's personal model is so others may live, what we're starting to see is this theme, this I'm all in for you, coming in both with your leadership philosophies and the way in which our rescue community operates. So I have to ask, and I know you've been asked this a lot, but how much has your experience as an isolated personnel in a personal recovery influenced your leadership philosophies over the years?
It taught me so much. When that team came in and picked me up, when you're alone in enemy territory and you can see the enemy over the horizon, the most beautiful sight in the world, when the helo touched down and we'd worked the rescue in many ways very similar to Vietnam style rescues because a lot of technology issues that night. Mm-hmm. And so I had sort of talked them to my location, put an IR strobe out.
Sure.
Right, and then they put down right on top of the strobe, and at that point the enemy knew exactly where we are. They'd been out there looking for me for 2 hours, and they came racing in our direction, shooting wildly into the tree line. You know how they teach you, be submissive, they gotta know it's you, you gotta authenticate, you know, all those things. I mean, I ran towards the helo, Jeremy Hardy and Andy Kubik and Ronnie Ellis jumped out. I meet Andy and Jeremy, and I think our total authentication was, let's go.
Yes, sir.
Right? And then we jumped on it. So from that experience, I thought a lot about over the years. These guys risked everything to get me out. Brought me back to my squadron, my family. Right? I'm sitting here today as a grandfather. I wouldn't be sitting here today if it wasn't for them. And so there's three words that I use as my mirror check all the way through Chief and then into this chapter two that I'm in now that sort of encapsulate leadership, this journey of being a inspirational servant leader. Mm-hmm. And that's, am I worthy? Am I worthy of the risk of these young men and now young women who risked everything as the sun was about to come up over enemy territory to pick me up and get me home? Am I worthy of the trust and confidence the American people have placed in me as a leader when they've entrusted to me the care of their sons and daughters, the greatest treasure in our nation's arsenal? And the only answer I found acceptable to that question is, God, I hope so.
Sure.
I hope I'm living my life in a way that makes them want to follow me. I hope I'm treasuring every moment of this gift of leadership that they're offering. And I hope I work every day to earn and re-earn that gift and never, ever feel entitled to anything. And so those young men taught me a ton, and I've used that lesson throughout my career and offer it to others.
Well, a lot of times we talk about servant leadership, and it's a model for leadership and the way you do it as if it's something that can be achieved. But the way you lay it out there, this is not something to achieve. This is a journey. It's a continual. It's very humbling, sir. I appreciate that.
Well, I can tell you that I sit here today, retired now for 4 years, and I'm still not the leader I want to be.
Sure.
The journey never ends. And I honestly believe that once we start believing that we've arrived, that we've got it all figured out, the end result of that is we stop learning, we stop listening, and we stop growing as leaders. And so when I was interviewing officers for a key leadership position, even as chief of staff, when I was looking for folks I would push forward to the secretary for a combatant commander or vice chief or any key leader, one of the things I really try to dig into was, are they still growing? Mm-hmm. Are they still curious? Are they still willing to adapt in this new position? Or have they arrived and planted the flag? You know, in some ways, that's the glass ceiling for senior leaders. And so I'm not where I want to be yet. And I don't think I'll ever arrive until I'm 6 foot under.
Yes, sir. You mentioned curious there. We're going to talk a little bit about our new mission command philosophy, and I'm going to come back to curious if we do that. But I'd like to pull out a couple things. I thought I might save it for later, but since we're talking about it, one of the things we're developing here is a leadership doctrine. So it exists in the past. We're bringing it back, revamping it for the future environment. We're looking at the airman ethos. What is that? And so one of the discussions is about, is there an airman ethos, but is there also a personal ethos? What personally drives me? And of course, it would be in line with the airman thing. And so I think you provide us a lot there to think about. So thank you. One of the things that, as we start to move into the PR episode, one thing that we like to think about is that this PR mission, it's very kind of unique to the U.S. in terms of the amount of emphasis and resources we put towards that. It seems to us that there might be both an internal and an external strategic importance to that. And so to kind of pull apart the internal part, how did it make you, knowing your aircraft was damaged and you're going down, that somebody is coming to get you? And before you even took off, you knew that if it happened, somebody was going to come. What kind of message does that send to our force?
You know, in my career, whether because of luck or timing or both, I never missed a fight. From Desert Storm through Iraqi Freedom and Enduring Freedom, I was in every one, right, to include the two Balkan campaigns over Bosnia and Kosovo. And in the first Bosnia campaign, I had an interesting experience. I was aide-de-camp for a guy named Lieutenant General Mike Ryan. For the first, I don't know how many days of the campaign, he didn't sleep much. And there was, you know, we had finally gotten into a battle with him. And he was taking one of his first full nights of sleep. And someone came in and showed me a picture. And we'd lost a tornado over Bosnia. And someone came and showed me a picture that had a crossroad, dirt road, a SOS sign that had been carved in the middle of the circle. Mm-hmm. And an individual that looked like a downed airman that was pointing towards the SOS. And we'd gotten emissions, friendly emissions from that area. And they'd been down for several days, and the question was, do we launch a combat search and rescue on this information? Was it enough or not? When they brought it to me, I knew immediately I needed to go wake up my boss. So I head over to his place, call him first, tell him, hey, sir, I'm sorry to wake you up, but I gotta show you something. And so I showed him all the information. I said, the team will tell you this is all they got. They got one overhead photo, and they got some emissions. That's it. And he said, looked at me, you know, pondered it for a minute, and then he looked up and he said, scramble the team, we're going in, let's go. And so we went back, sat down, and he never wavered. He sent the team in. It turned out to be a complete ambush. If you remember that, Ebro 3-3, right? Yes, they went in, they got all shot up, a few people got shot, luckily nobody killed, and then within 2 hours after that, the two downed airmen were on CNN. But here's the interesting part. The fact that we would sacrifice and risk American forces to go down and again and get a coalition member kept the coalition together. I was privy to more phone calls from international teammates that were part of the coalition who thanked Mike Ryan for taking that risk. And then when the campaign started going through some rough spots, right, the fact that we had done that for another nation helped keep the coalition together. That was a pretty formative experience for me in terms of understanding the power of PR, wow, the power of combat search and rescue in a coalition environment. Because for all nations that were gathered together, we knew going in that if someone went down, no one would rest until they got home. And so when it was my turn, some many years later, I had no question I was getting out that night. And I had no question that the nation would not sleep until I was safely home. And what was interesting is a couple years later, I was in school with the State Department for senior level PME. And we did these sessions around Washington, D.C., and every three-letter agency that we visited would give us their sort of mission brief. And I can't tell you the number of agencies in their briefing, not knowing who I was as just a student out of uniform, would in their mission brief, I mean, I had the director of the CIA say, we're the organization that found Hammer 3-4, this F-16 guy that went down. Every agency was taking pride in having a role in this. And I just sat there and thought, that's what it looks like to have the entire nation engaged in bringing one of their own home. I mean, it's powerful.
It is very powerful. On the other side, there certainly is a reason beyond just the messaging to our airmen. There's a danger of, because we empower our airmen so much and we trust them, there's a danger of allowing them to be exploited. I know, perhaps you had some questions that you wanted to kind of talk about that side of it as well.
Yeah, so we want to discuss what the strategic impact would have been in the event that you had been rolled up, or either yourself or Lieutenant Colonel Zelko, who was Vega 3-1, who had been shot down a few weeks prior. The situation going on in Serbia at the time, what would have been the strategic impact or the operational impact in that theater had one of you two been captured?
Yeah, Dale and I have met and talked over the years. Interestingly enough, you know, I don't know if you know the story, but we got shot down by the same guy.
That's right. Same operator.
And we, you know, his call sign is MacGyver, right? Because he was able to rewire his system so neither of us saw what was coming at us. Dale's actually met him. I think they've become friends over the years. I've never gone back into Serbia, but I have told the LPA, the Lieutenants Protection Association, I said, hey, grab a van, go into Belgrade and get my stuff. It's not theirs, you know. So hopefully everybody out there knows that's just a joke, right? But I was not a young captain who got shot down. I was a lieutenant colonel and I was a squadron commander. I would have been wonderful for the Serbians to exploit, right? If they had been able to showcase that they shot down the squadron commander of the Triple Nickel. But it's interesting that that was never going through my mind the entire time I was on the ground. Because I'd been part of Desert Storm, you know, one of the guys in my outfit that got shot down was Bill Andrews. And Bill was taken, you know, was captured, was a POW, had some pretty severe injuries. Fascinating story, escaped, and then was recaptured during the ending days of Desert Storm. There was a rescue helo that went in to get him out, and it was shot down as well. And we lost some folks on that, as well as, you know, folks pretty significantly injured. Because I'd been part of that story, I was really concerned about losing someone coming in after me and contributing to them getting shot down and then having to live with that forever. So I was so focused on not screwing up my part, staying off the radios, not giving the enemy a vector towards my location, not putting the helos at risk. And so you might remember that we had a brand new radio. Let's just say that we had been told that without having to say anything on the radio, there was methods through friendly forces to be able to locate where we were. So what we had been told was, hey, don't talk much on the radio. Every time you use the radio, they're going to know where you are. Well, that technology didn't work that night. And so when I first came back after evading the enemy who got really close to me, you know, earlier in the situation, I came up on the radio thinking, okay, we're probably close to helos being scrambled, airborne, en route. I'm going to check in. And the first call I hear back is, the force is in country and they're looking for you. And I remember just thinking, damn, how can they be looking for me? I've been transmitting my location this entire time. And I immediately thought of Bill Andrews and losing helo. And so at that point, I became a pretty aggressive participant in the rescue, not only because it was time to go home, but more than anything, I did not want to risk the brave young men, because we didn't have women at the time. We fixed that since, which I'm glad But that night it was young men who were risking everything they hold dear to get me out.
It's interesting you say you became an aggressive participant in your own rescue. I remember going through the SEER school, and something that we reiterate in our CSAR training, our SANI training, the A10 community, is the survivor needs to, quote, affect their own rescue. And so there is an onus on an isolated personnel to understand their systems and understand the procedures and study their ISO prep, study their EPA, so that mm-hmm. they can be that aggressive participant. It's interesting you mentioned the technology not functioning correctly. I do remember you came and spoke to our unit at OSON one time, and I remember you saying, why do we still have search in combat search and rescue? And so the technology has changed and evolved, and now we have more systems, but even those systems, as improved as they are, we still have to organize and train to be able to accomplish that rescue underneath the unfortunate circumstance that it doesn't work. I wanted to ask you, in your experience as a CFAC and CENTCOM, how did you work to organize and prepare your forces for PR in that theater? How did you arrange your forces in that theater, and what was your approach to personnel recovery and the attitudes toward personnel recovery in CENTCOM?
Well, first of all, I made sure that it was a combined and a joint operation, not an Air Force operation. Not only from the perspective of how we executed, but who we executed for. Again, going back to Ebro 3-3 and that experience, I knew that this is an international mission in support of an international coalition. Since I've retired, I mean, I'll talk a little bit about the CFAC, but I'll share this with you. So since I retired, right, I got this new call sign, JD for Just Dave, and now I'm a master at Uber. When I travel, Uber, in my mind, is the technology of future search and rescue. And I agree with you, not search and rescue, because we ought to have enough technology to know exactly where people are. So this is combat rescue. So think about Uber. You guys both used it, right? So first of all, you have a common operational picture that is shared by everyone else who is also using that technology. You have a series of options in terms of what kind of transportation that will be matched with the target, which is the downed individual. You can select what is the best for your particular situation. You get a timeline, and in the operational picture, you can watch the mode of travel that you've selected get to you. And if you start thinking creatively, you can execute other plans that would cause the enemy to go elsewhere, that would message. I mean, if you think about just how you use Uber to get out or away from wherever your current location is, and think about that technology for the future, that to me is quite interesting. So back now to being the CFAC, I certainly didn't have all that technology, but what I did have access to was some of the best technologists on the planet. And when I walked them through this sort of vision for the future, and again, the mode you select could be manned, could be unmanned, could be airborne, could be land, could be a number of different things. And who is going to be the person that's going to have the best situational awareness on what mode will be the most effective is going to be the individual who's running the app. And so we brought in some of that technology in CENTCOM, and we're sort of in a continual upgrade mode of trying to build this plan where we would not have to do it in the sort of Vietnam era way, which is voice commands, vector them to your location, a helo that's a pickup vehicle plus all supporting vehicles. I mean, what, quite frankly, you and I, as a Sandy, all grew up with. The future, I think, with technology is very exciting. And I know we brought this same thinking back to the Joint Combat Search and Rescue Organization, Brigadier General Kunkel, who was actually Captain Kunkel on my rescue, you know, led that organization, so he and I spent a lot of time working through it. So there's some really exciting options out there that I do believe can take the search out of search and rescue and provide a variety of ways to get now.
I think that kind of out-of-the-box thinking may be the answer you give me to my next question, but as we look to the future environment, well, current and future environment of contested, degraded operations, resource-intensive missions like personnel recovery become a delicate balancing act for a CFAC or even JFC or COCOM, depending on the level. So as we kind of look at that, how do leaders at that level start balancing those kind of resource intensive? Understanding there's no clear answer, but I'm curious on your thoughts.
Industry, I think, can be a pretty helpful partner in this. You know, I went out to a track two discussion at Hoover as chief institute at Stanford. And I was on a panel with the gentleman named Karan Bhatia, who is head of policy for Google. And he looked at me and he said, "So, Chief, what are you doing out here and what do you want out of this discussion?" And I said, "Well," I said, "Karan, you know, you and I share something in common. We both lead garage startups." And he said, looked at me, he says, "Really? What are you talking about?" I said, "Well, you know, you got Larry and Sergey. I got Orville and Wilbur." You know, two bicycle mechanics, you know, tinkering in a garage. The rest is history, right? I said, "But the reality is, I'm also the chief of staff of a service that's clearly a hardware company. And our focus is on platform, sensors, and weapons. Always has been. But my future is not in platform, sensors, and weapons. My future is not in hardware. It's in software. And the currency of future conflict is not weapons and munitions. It's data. And so I got to transition my company from hardware to software. And I can't do it without you. So I'm here to get industry's help." And I said, "And by the way, I've got this academy that is just the only one west of the Mississippi. And when the cadets climb Pike's Peak, they can see Silicon Valley." I said, "We ought to work some prisoner exchanges between the Air Force and Google, right? Or Apple," or I had this conversation with all of them, you know, "and let's get your young tech professionals and my young cadets and techies in the Air Force, let's get them talking together about this going forward." So I really think that industry is eager to put engineering talent against this problem set. And the right partnering and the right teaming with the right forward-leaning, fast-moving companies that have artificial intelligence built into them can probably move this much faster than we can do if it's all organic to the Air Force or the Department of Defense. Because this is one mission of many. It may be an Air Force lead, but it's not to serve only Air Force individuals. We're there to rescue the French, you know, Mirage pilots or Tornado pilots or Italians that just got shot down, or the Singapore or Emirati, I mean, you name it. We're there to do this together, and the more we can bring them into it and use their resources, the more modes of travel are going to show up on our app.
Sir. So I think that's a great point. Having industry involved in distributing the technology and making it available to our other coalition partners and nations that are going to be working with us is important. One of the things that is a challenge to the rescue community is having to work with so many different types of isolated personnel that have different technologies and trying to understand what their capabilities are. It's certainly a challenge going through training and trying to determine, okay, what kind of survival radio does this isolated personnel have? What does he have a GPS? Does he not? Does he understand the spins? And that's something that our PR doctrine helps to try to standardize that. But having a common set of software that can be integrated across multiple different services and different coalition partners, it would simplify that problem to a degree. So I think that's an interesting point. You certainly had to deal with the coalition partners in your time as the CFAC and CENTCOM, but I wanted to ask, you were setting up personnel recovery operations and possibly having to do personnel recovery events in a counterinsurgency environment. How do you perceive that that will change in a large-scale combat operation for the future? What does PR look like to you going forward, given these advances in technology that we're trying to acquire?
In my mind, it goes back to that, all right, the currency of future conflict is data. Who has it? Who can manipulate it? Who can use it, fuse it, and as a result, make faster and better decisions? Because once somebody is behind enemy lines and they're on their own, the race is on and every second counts. You know, this is a Sandy, right? Every second counts. So how do we ensure that we're making use of all the tools available so that we are faster than the adversary? because if they get to them first, I mean, there is no second place in this business. You either succeed or you fail. And so, again, you sort of think about technology. What's interesting about artificial intelligence and information technology is, unlike hardware, small countries are actually developing at extremely fast rates. I remember a briefing I got from my Australian counterpart on a Project Jericho that they had laid out, which was their transition. And I, as he was talking to me, I thought, man, what an incredible marriage that we have here. I bring mass, and what they bring is speed and technology. I bring this large, sometimes perhaps lumbersome organization, but it's huge, this United States Air Force or this Joint Force, right? And they bring this very highly technical operation that is digitized, that moves speed. And my question was, okay, how does 1 + 1 = 3? How do I marry mass and speed and technology in a way that we can do the mission even better than if it was all mass or all speed? So I use Australia as an example, but I could go around the world, and everyone is developing in the IT space. Everyone is building algorithms. Everyone is thinking through artificial intelligence, how to apply it. So you could look at this as challenge or opportunity. The challenge, of course, being, wow, this is really cumbersome and huge and massive number of people and players. Or the opportunity is, hey, I can lash together in really unique ways the best of each individual country to come up with some solutions that would be so much faster than the adversary. Because if you think about our potential adversaries, who are their partners? Who are their Australias? Who are their Japans? Who is their UK, their Saudi teammates who bring to the table what I'm describing? If you're China, Russia, Iran, or North Korea, then I would say the answer is that's our advantage. We ought to make every use of it. By the way, our teammates are just as passionate about getting their downed folks out as we are.
Listening to that, one of the Joint All Domain Command and Control acronym has changed a bit over the years. It was a big part of your tenure as CSAT. And so as we look at a lot of what you're talking about and the ability to command and control, which is at the center of all of our functions, including PR, the challenges associated with that, we talk a lot about the technology which supports it, but you also have outlined a lot of relationships and the importance of the relationships in doing that. So to help us kind of understand JADC2 and JADO is large. Can you talk a little bit about the development of that and give us some background of the problems that it addressed and the importance of relationship building in that?
Yeah, so I lost the acronym war.
Yes, sir.
JADC2. But it came from a unique experience I had as a CFAC. Mm-hmm. So one of my responsibilities was as the support head commander for the combined defense of the Arabian Gulf. And to do that mission, to protect the nations of the Gulf Cooperation Council, the GCC, against missile attack primarily or air attack from Iran, I was given Navy assets, Aegis cruisers, carrier air wings. I was given Marine Corps fighter squadrons. I was given Army Patriot batteries and THAAD batteries. Every country contributed not only technology but also defensive systems, sky guards, fighter airplanes on alert, right? So I had a pretty robust capability. No, by the way, 14th Air Force, I was the Air and Space Commander, right? So 14th Air Force also provided me with all the space capabilities I needed. So I'm standing on the catwalk of the most sophisticated headquarters on the planet there at Al-Udeid, and I've got my boss, General Mattis, standing next to me, and I'm looking down the floor. And I said, boss, you know, here's what I've learned in this mission. He said, what's that? I said, there is no I in IAMD. There is no integrated in integrated air missile defense, because that space team has assets made by, I'll pick a company, Boeing.
Right.
And those systems proprietize their data. It is no longer shareable because they're not going to share it with those doggone L3 Harris guys that are right now, you know, right next to them on the floor doing combat search and rescue. And the two of them for sure ain't going to support the Lockheed Martin folks who are over here. And then you go around the room. This is no hit on industry because we had incentivized them to do just that.
Yes, sir.
And then we would pay twice at the pump by going back to them and saying, hey, can you build me a gateway? I don't know how to spell gateway, but it should be a four-letter word, right?
Yeah.
Because they're cumbersome, they're slow, and they're massively expensive, and they rarely really work. So therein lies the genesis of what became JADC2, was that experience that, okay, I have got to find a way to connect. And so as we walked our way through it as a joint team, I learned that it was not as much a technical problem as a cultural problem. And when you're trying to change culture, that takes time. And I am proud looking back that it took 4 years to change the narrative from whether we needed to do JADC2 to how do we do JADC2.
Right.
And one of my advisors at the time was Eric Schmidt, you know, former CEO at Google. And one of the things he told me that I took to heart, he said, Dave, he goes, I totally get where you're going. He goes, don't eat the whole elephant. Because if you try to eat it all, he goes, it'll crush you with its weight. And he goes, and other people will get in place with resistance. And he said, if you really want to kill it, he goes, I got advice for you. He goes, just make it a program of record. He said, that'll absolutely kill it. That'll be the death knell, right? So the way we approached it is we started by taking combatant commander problems, getting a sponsor, and then with my joint teammates, building trust and confidence that I was not trying to, as the Air Force guy, take over their Project Convergence, their systems, and that they had spent billions of dollars building, that I, as an airman, would spend the time to truly understand what the Army's needs were and acknowledge the fact that, well, I was culturally probably thinking about 5,000 airplanes or 8,000 airplanes, the Chief of Staff of the Army is thinking about 1 million soldiers. Well, I'm thinking about operating at 350 knots. He's thinking about operating at 30 knots, right? And so how do we build trust? At one point as chief, I actually put about $10 million of Air Force money against solving an Army problem. And when my programmers looked at me and said, sir, what are you doing? I said, we're investing in trust. I need them to know that I'm absolutely dead serious about the J in Joint All Domain Command and Control. And if I was them, I wouldn't trust me. So we got to show them. We got to be true to this, and we got to move it forward. That, in many ways, slowed us down quite a bit, but hopefully it also helped us speed up. And so by the time I left, after 4 years of advocating for this, I was happy with the fact that when I left, all the chiefs were in a dialogue about, okay, how do we get this done? And we were no longer in a discussion about whether it needed to happen.
That's fantastic, sir. You mentioned a couple of things in there that I wanted to bridge into our newest publication, Mission Command. So as we're writing Mission Command and we're looking at your book and a lot of the inspirational leaders over the years, what we find is the Air Force in a lot of ways has been talking about Mission Command long before we used Mission Command. We've been talking about pushing authorities down, championing competence and character. We've been doing a lot of this. And so you mentioned there that JADC2, this joint all domain approaches, a lot of it is culture. A lot of it is invested in trust among partners, among each other. As you were building this culture of revitalizing the squadrons and empowering leaders, what were some of the barriers that you saw at your time, and what are some that may be facing us in the future?
Well, for those who've read the book, which is in its 13th printing, my concern as chief, and having been the CFAC, and again, sort of not missing a fight, was that when I was a squadron commander during Operation Allied Force, I had so much authority for decision-making that was just sort of built in. It was part of my training, it was part of my upbringing. And then essentially at the time for 15 and eventually became 20 years of conflict in the Middle East, it was a unique kind of combat operation. We were pretty much uncontested in the air for the most part, if you think about it. There was nobody really on the ground that was shooting at us in either Afghanistan or Iraq for the majority of that time. Not all the time, but majority of that time. And so when you're in an area where in the air domain you're uncontested, it offers the opportunity for leaders, because you control the rheostat of time in this conflict to a large extent, it allows you to pull decision authority up to higher levels. The one scenario that I always remember and think about, which is we announced a month prior to going into, gosh, now I don't remember what the name of the city was in Iraq to retake it. It wasn't Fallujah. We announced a month prior that we were going in to retake the city. And we even put our basic fundamental tactics out there. We told the enemy exactly what we could, because you know what? There wasn't a damn thing they could do about it. And we executed, and we took back the town. Such is the nature of conflict when you're uncontested in a domain like air, and when you have an adversary that really can't stop you. The downside of being in that situation is that decisions now can be controlled at a much higher level. And so my worry is that culturally, we had continued to pull decisions away from squadron commanders, where the rubber meets the road and where real success happens. And we pulled it up to group and wing command and higher in a way that was going to fail miserably in a campaign against a peer. And so my challenge as chief and the opportunity as chief was, how do I get decision authority back where it belongs? The way we present forces is through squadrons. Where we accomplish the mission is through squadrons. Where we understand and know our people at a very personal level is at squadron. It's who we are, and it's who as an Air Force we've always been and always will be. And so pushing decision authority down, and that's a cultural change, was central to where we were going. And we also pushed resources down. So I took over as a wing commander at Spangdahlem the year that that wing won the Installation Excellence Award. It's the only award that comes with money.
Oh, wow.
You get $1 million.
Oh, wow.
If you win that, it's $1 million to spend. And so my predecessor, Steve Mueller, won it, and then I got to spend it. You know, timing's everything. Unbelievable what we did with that $1 million. Because most of what we did was self-help. It was listening to airmen, determining what they felt that they needed. And this wasn't flat screen TVs and basketball courts. This is mission, innovation, and ideas that they had. And we paid for what we needed to pay for, and we did self-help for the rest. And we basically changed that wing with $1 million. And so the question I asked the staff as we were pushing decision authority down is, if I'm giving the decision authority, I got to put my money where my mouth is. So how much is it going to take out of the Air Force budget for me to make every wing commander in the Air Force an Installation Excellence Award winner, and then cut them loose to spend it on what they know they need to do their mission better? And that's where the wing and squadron innovation funds came from. And every year they came back to me and said, sure, we really want to spend this money on this other thing. You know, it's really important. I said, okay, so here's the way it works. You come to me and ask me to spend it elsewhere, I want you to double the money. So go back next year, and I want you to put double the money into the innovation funds. Yeah, they learned not to come to me asking me anymore. And they knew I was dead serious about it, because, hey, this was not about just love and sparring commanders. This is about getting ready for the next big fight. Because the next big fight, we're not going to control the rheostat of conflict. We're not going to be an uncontested environment. We're going to need squadron commanders who know how to take risk, stumble, fail, pick themselves up, go again. And we need to have senior leaders that got their backs. And so that was what it was all about.
It's interesting there. When we wrote the doctrine, you know, accepting prudent risk was an important part of that. And we tried to say, well, what's prudent risk? What's the lowest appropriate level? And the story you told there, and I just want to follow up on that. You had this additional funds, and it wasn't flat screens. Airmen wanted more mission. That's fascinating to me. It makes me think that getting the authorities down actually gets us more mission. It makes us more effective, even when it's not necessary. So I guess my next question is it purely organizational? Do I just need to change a bunch of regs to give them a waiver authority, which you did, by the way, which was fantastic as a Stanoval guy? Thank you for that. But is it cognitive as well? Do we have to kind of change our mental map of what is acceptable? Instead of asking my boss, I need to take that ownership. Is there a cognitive piece?
There's something that happens to every airman, officer especially, and I believe it happens when we go through basic. Someone sneaks in our room, pulls out a syringe, injects us with this idea that gets parked in our brain. We don't even know it's there. And it's this little message that comes out when we become kernels. And all of a sudden it pops in our brain and it says, screw with the org chart. Okay, how many times have we moved the boxes and lines around and then all resettled right back in the same way of doing business beforehand, but yet causing significant disruption along the way? So I tried to be very disciplined that form had to follow function. The staff first needed to show me how we would change the way we were doing business, fundamentally change the process of what we were doing, and then show me the organization that will best support that going forward. So the essence of your question, which is it cognitive and cultural versus technological? I think, quite frankly, it's about 80-20. It's 80% cognitive and cultural and about 20% technical. The technical part on much of what we want to work towards, now that I've been retired and I'm working with various industries like chairing a board for Google, and I'm getting to know the culture of Google. Mm-hmm. And now that I've been with them more than a year, I can actually call myself a Googler. My first year, I was a Noogler, right? and I see this essence of sort of what Larry and Sergey started way back when, right, which is hire the most incredible talent, engineering talent, create an environment where they can just thrive, and then cut them loose on solving the hardest challenges that are out there. This challenge to do combat rescue, solving the search problem in a multimodal coalition joint environment that allows encrypted communications that starts when the emergency procedure is unfolding with messages and artificial intelligence and other avenues. To me, truly, there's unlimited opportunity for us to solve this. The technology is going to be there. We just got to make sure that we're not too protective of our tribes. Mm-hmm. When the tribes now have different functions, that we don't slow the train down because we want to keep doing business the way we all grew up, when we all know that it's probably not the most effective or efficient. And so if we can get ourselves on the Uber train, I think there's no stopping us.
Sure. Well, we're getting towards the end here, and I got a final question for you, but I want to thank you for your time. It's been absolutely fantastic. I've learned a great deal.
No, this has been wonderful. The discussion, especially revolving around personnel recovery, not just for our service, but especially our coalition partners. And I think that's something the CAFR at large tends to not focus on, or they tend to forget at times, is we don't just do PR for U.S. Air Force. We got to take care of our coalition partners too. So that, I thought that was a great discussion that we had on that subject.
So, sir, kind of in closing here, you've mentioned in the past, a recent talk to our Air War College, three traits that you look for in leaders. And I noticed that competence and character were two of the ones that's included in mission command. And you had the third one you mentioned earlier, curious. So kind of in conclusion here, I thought I'd give you an opportunity to talk about those three traits that you think leaders should focus on.
We talked the curious part, so I'll focus more on that character and competence piece. So I happen to be the director of the joint staff for Chairman Marty Dempsey in his second term, meaning last 2 years of his four-year term. And we had gone through a couple of really unfortunate events in the Middle East. Abu Ghraib prison, Staff Sergeant Bales in Afghanistan. And we'd had a series of these breakdown in values where we were clearly not operating at the level that the American people and our coalition teammates expected us to operate at. I thought the American people, there was a good chance they were going to leave us after some of those incidents. And Chairman Dempsey called me in and he goes, hey, I want you to lead a review. And the test question is, have we lost our balance between character and competence? Are we unintentionally, because we've been at war so long, are we rewarding competence and excusing character? Are we incentivizing folks to be overly aggressive and in the process forgetting that we bring our values with us when we go to war? And so every service did a review. Special Operations Command, CENTCOM, everyone, we did a review, and we took several months, and we came to the conclusion that we had lost our way a bit, and it was time to recenter ourselves. And the lead in the Air Force organization for doing that was AFSOC, who took the lead. And General Webb at the time was the AFSOC commander, had done his own review and said, yeah, we got to recenter this and make sure that we perform in combat the way the American people expect. And there's this one scene I will never forget, sort of brought it all into focus for me. I was at Bagram, and I was at the hospital, and we just had a mass casualty. And so we had every operating room double stuffed with two patients, two surgical teams operating to save life and limb. A line as long as you could see it to donate blood because the word had gone out. And in that line were active guard, reserve, every service, coalition teammates, contractors, you name it. They were there to give blood that day for mainly the soldiers in that particular fight and a few airmen who had been injured. And because I was the commander and the hospital was part of the command, I went in and they actually allowed me to stick my head into a operating room just to say a few words to the surgical teams. In this one room I looked into, they told me on the table was the shooter and his victim. So we had a member of the Taliban that was being operated on in an OR with the exact same passion to save life and limb as the individual he shot, and they were head-to-head, right, that close in the operating room. And the question some might have is, well, who does that? That's pretty confusing. Who does that? And the answer is we do, because we take our values with us. You know, that was an individual, he was an enemy, but he was also a son, a husband, and someone that you work on. And so character and competence are not just traits we talk about. It's a balance. And the American people have every right to demand both in equal measure in those who do the most difficult work a nation can ever ask anyone to do. Jeff Bezos told me one time, he said, Dave, the reason the military is held in such high regard is because you do hard things really well. And the American people have come to expect that you will do the hardest things really well. We can only do those hardest things if we keep character and competence in balance.
That's going to do it for this week's podcast. The show is recorded, edited, and produced by the LeMay Center's Doctrine Outreach Section. Special thanks to General Goldfein, his staff, the LeMay Center, and Air University. As always, the views expressed by our guests and hosts are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of Air University, the Air Force, or any government agency. I'm Nicholas Underwood. We will see you next time.